coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly. Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK, and welcome back to our weekly survey of the Bible lessons for each Sunday of the church year with me, Jamie Krieger, David Weber, and Ethan Stoppenhagen. On today's episode, we will look at the lessons for the fourth Sunday of Easter, also called Good Shepherd Sunday. And the readings are Acts 4 verses 1 to 12, Psalm 23, 1 John 3 verses 16 to 24, and the Gospel according to John chapter 10 verses 11 to 18.
Here on the fourth Sunday of Easter, we continue to reflect on the new resurrection reality. And part of this reality is a unity in the flock of Christ. Jesus says there will be one flock and one shepherd. Now, it's always, this is one of the most difficult texts for me to preach, at least. I don't know about you, David, because there is, I think, this tendency to reduce the text to just sort of an emotive, comfortable feeling of love and peace. And it doesn't acknowledge some of the wider implications of what it means to be the flock and to have Christ as the Good Shepherd. Because when we think about a flock or and the unity of a flock of sheep, usually we think of the herd mentality, right? Where we're all easily led about by some authority figure or by market fads. And this is often how Christians are perceived in the wider culture, that we're uncritical, easily persuaded, and we just follow the crowd. We're not able to think for ourselves. So I would argue that when Jesus says, "I am the good shepherd," he's offering a different kind of unity that's grounded in sacrifice and knowledge, that at the same time raises up the individual, yet brings that individual to share in the one mind of Christ. So you get these two complementary elements of sacrifice and knowledge. Does that sound like a good approach to start with, David?
All those words, it sounds like it would be good for you, because you're going to have to resolve what this text is actually saying on that particular time, because it's saying all those things that you said, right? And I was just making notes as you were talking about it, and so I made three quick notes. The goodness of the Good Shepherd is by no means self-evident. The hireling doesn't think that that way of living is good. I think if once we get into the granular details of this passage, a lot of people, especially when you see that the Good Shepherd means laying down one's life for, as Jesus will say elsewhere, for the enemy. I rarely, if ever, have dealt with a congregational member or myself that thought that it was reasonable to love the enemy. And yet that's the implications, right? So the very term good is up for grabs. I don't know that that's sermon material, but it does, it does strike me as very interesting that just because we say the word good doesn't mean that there is, as you say, unity in accepting that as as the mark of goodness. And I actually think that in this case, while, you know, goodness, you know, every philosopher has said human beings naturally pursue the good. They just have different definitions of what is good. I think the goodness of Jesus is not in any way self-evident. Certainly wasn't self-evident to his disciples, that when they were on the other side of the resurrection, they did not see laying down his life as good. So I think from the very beginning, I would want a sermon to help me understand, not only understand this goodness, but also to understand how I can, who resists this definition of goodness, how it can actually be a part of my life. Now, I would want that until I have other concerns. You mentioned unity. You know, and I've been doing a lot of reading about how loneliness is a major health problem, at least in the United States. that people don't any longer understand what it means to live in community. And so I would be, my ears perked up with that. And I would wonder, what does this text say about a major problem in, among people today? And then my mind wandered, and when you were talking to Psalm 23, and I wondered, whether we all need shepherding. And if that's the case, how is shepherding going on now, and why are, you know, Christians so nonchalant about having shepherding in their lives? So, see, I didn't help at all.
No, you did. No, you did. I think it's good to step back and ask that question about the goodness of the shepherd. And I took that for granted as I considered this, because I, talking about sacrifice, the sacrifice that leads to unity, I took good as a given, that sacrifice is good. And so we sort of have to ask then, how can that destructive act actually bring about unity? What does it do? In my understanding, I would say that sacrifice actually enhances an awareness of the individual in the sense of laying down one's life. Granted, Jesus lays down his life for the sheep, for the whole flock. But there is, I think in that act of sacrifice, there is, it's an act of freedom, right? Because Jesus says he lays down his life of his own accord. So he's not being manipulated. He doesn't have a power or an authority telling him to do that. He has the authority himself. So that pushes against us the idea of the herd mentality, and that this one person is making the sacrifice of his own accord. So that heightens the awareness of the individual, but at the same time that proceeds from the knowledge, the knowledge that Jesus says that he shares with the Father, just as the Father knows me and I know the Father. That's how he knows his own, and his own know me.
You're making sacrifice, but when you approach this, your one idea that you want to develop is, do I have this right? The goodness of sacrifice.
So that's the thing. It's, I want to weave in the knowledge though, too. I think there's the knowledge of, perhaps the knowledge of the will of the Father is what leads to this sacrifice that brings about unity, and it's sort of like a self-perpetuating cycle. Because if you think about knowledge and the pursuit of knowledge, that in itself is a communal activity.
It is, but I would expand it, because and at the end of the verse, Jesus defines knowing as my sheep know me, right? They don't know about me. That there is, so I do see a connection between this sacrifice and knowing. I think that the sacrifice is, the act of sacrifice is the one thing by which a person develops trust with another person. You know, that sacrifice, it makes the bond of trust. I think that's why our parents, we trust our parents, because they did so much naturally, sacrificially for us. And I think Jesus develops his relationship with us by us seeing the goodness of his sacrifice, and that brings about the knowing you're talking about. But I'll dispute with you. I don't think the goodness of the sacrifice is obvious, or that we are willing to say that is the good that I want in my life.
Is that then why we need the, not just the knowledge, but even a pursuit or a communication of knowledge that reveals through the word, through experience, that sacrifice is actually a good thing?
I think that knowing Jesus in the most intimate sense of the word, that's the offer. When we talk about God's presence, what we're talking about, it being real, that it's really possible to know God, and to know God, you know, intimately is the term, and to know, and that's a big topic, God. But Jesus says, you know, We can narrow this topic that to know the goodness of God is to know of his sacrifice on the cross. And I like what you did is that I think the heart and center of the text is Jesus saying, of my own accord. Everybody mm-hmm. thought of sacrifice as something that the powerful inflict on the weak who can't, you know, you make others sacrifice for you. And I think that's what we naturally do. We want others to make the sacrifice. We don't want to make it. But Jesus turns it on his head. He says, you want to know what real goodness is? It's not having the power over others. Real goodness is having the freedom to be able to sacrifice in the way that he would demonstrate on the cross. So as common, what I like about it is that's not an uncommon image. It's as common as any shepherd. There is no flock of sheep unless the shepherd actually embodies that attitude towards sacrifice. So
would any shepherd actually lay down his life for the flock?
Yeah, okay, that's
I mean that I mean, so in some ways, I mean, of course he's embodying that protective presence, and Jesus is taking that to the next level.
Okay, then let me ask you a question. I don't know, is this just so idealistic that that people will say, yes, it's a lovely image, but it has no purchase in my daily life? There isn't a shepherd who actually would do that, right?
Yeah.
So that removes it from reality. So we have a nice, emotionally satisfying sermon that has no relevance in a person's life. And I think the opposite here. I think this passage is setting out to radically adjust our understanding of what we mean by good. And that good is defined not what's good for me, but by Christ's own sacrifice. And that goodness, what I really like about that goodness is in the freedom that Christ made his sacrifice with. This wasn't compelled. And that all goodness in this world is at its best when it's not compelled.
Right.
Well, so now what do we do with that?
Well, we could keep going into the psalm, because my question is it's not compelled. So is there a point at which that idea of freedom, the ability to act freely that Jesus possesses, is there a point at which that is given to us?
I find it very appealing that the resurrection, Jesus is saying that his resurrection, because it's a victory over death, mm-hmm. gives me the freedom to give up my life for others. Now, I know, if I'm honest with myself, that freedom does not come spontaneously.
Right.
That I don't naturally or spontaneously give up my life for others. And I know that Lutherans like to say, oh, it comes naturally like good fruit coming from a good tree. I wish that was my case. Maybe other people are that way. The kind of goodness that Jesus has, I find it very desirable. I find it appealing because I've benefited, you know, from Jesus's sacrifice. But I'd also would like to follow that. So is this a passage that is meant for everybody? Or is it just a passage for those few people who are called to be shepherds? This laying down the sheep, is Jesus saying that all of the sheep in his flock are also learning to lay down their lives for others?
In some ways, I want to say that we all step into a shepherding role at some point in life.
See, I would answer, if you would have said, oh no, the clergy are a very special class, and usually when people talk about the clergy being a special class, it means that they have some kind of bureaucratic authority rather than the authority to be the first to lay down their life for others, to be sacrificial. But sadly, the history of clergy is not that. So, but here's what I like about this whole thing, that if in fact we are talking about loving as Christ loved, then every human being, the good in everyone's life is love. And that Jesus makes the audacious promise here that with his shepherding, we can actually, in some sense, really love as he loved, because we have been loved by him that way. That way, that to me is appealing, but it leaves so many other questions of, if that's the case, does this happen spontaneously as you think? I don't think it does. Or is this loving more like an athletic skill that needs practice? Or is this, is the church a place in which I am being continually surrounded by others, other novices who want to learn to love in this way? So, yeah, these are all the questions that's probably not helping getting to what it means to preach on this.
But it's spinning around all of the ideas that are there in the text, and not, it's not just the surface level of Jesus is a good shepherd, he loves you and he cares for you. Right? Psalm 23, when you hear that, you know, it is a great comfort.
Do you find it comforting?
So why not? Because I've been thinking about this psalm as a, you know, as Jesus sort of showing us his shepherding task, more so than us, you know, being comforted. Jesus is showing us how to be a shepherd and what it takes to lead people through till they finally dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Is that?
Well, I find that a funny image, that the shepherd is shepherding your sheep and then turning to the sheep and saying, oh, by the way, you're not going to remain sheep forever. You're doing this because you're going to all be shepherds. And I just find that if I could be a cartoonist, I would find that to be a funny moment, that the sheep trying to figure out, what, we're going to be shepherds like him? How is that going to happen? But here's why it's just unsettling to me, is that the shepherd has already promised the sheep that he is going to lead them in places that are going to scare them to the point that they would not themselves go in those places unless he led the way. So there's already a promise. Yes, there are green pastures in this scenario, but there are also dark valleys.
Right,
And probably the dark valleys are going to come before the green pastures.
And they're going to be really long.
Right, and so that goes back to my other question. Is this promise of that we can love as Christ loved, is that, but we have to be in the flock. That we have to be instructed or following or know intimately the life of the Good Shepherd before we could ever think of embodying this view of love.
That's the knowledge, right? That needs to be inculcated and formed in the believer, which is, it's a reflection of that knowledge that the Father and the Son have, which is the I think just the general will of the Father, that the Son gives up his life for the life of the world. And so we need to be led into that habitus, really. It's a new way of being.
So you would say we shouldn't think that this life of love, or what Kierkegaard called the works of love, is spontaneous. It is more, oh, I hate this word, intentional, but it is. It's that people recognize that within this church, we are, you know, we're going to do it badly, but it's still worth doing, to love as Jesus loved. And right, not because we think we can do it, but only because we are, in a sense, infatuated that we ourselves have a history of Jesus loving us in this way.
So, yeah, I think our spontaneous intuition is to be like the priests and the Sadducees in the Acts reading. What do they do when they hear the proclamation of Jesus? First, they're annoyed, and then they use their power to squash the proclamation. They don't, you know, and here's another word, you know, like being intentional. They aren't vulnerable, to actually set aside their power and their control and their preconceived notions to be able to listen to this new knowledge.
Well, that's why I think there's an argument about Jesus being the good shepherd. They see the goodness of Jesus, especially the freedom that he gave up his life on the cross, as threatening their bureaucratic authority.
Right.
That is a different kind of authority. That's not an authority that is an imposition from top down. It's an authority of changing the heart from the inside out. And I really like that, your focus on their resistance to the proclamation of the goodness of the good shepherd. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was saying earlier. I don't think that this goodness is universally accepted.
Right.
It doesn't look like goodness from a number of different perspectives.
What is good is me and me building up my name, and my reputation. And I think that's what the rulers and the authorities, that's ultimately what their end goal is. And Peter finally says, you know, it's not about that. It's about Jesus, the stone whom you rejected has become the cornerstone, and there is no salvation in anyone else. There's only the one name under heaven, which is the name of Jesus, by which we can be saved.
Yeah, and that's why I think that their resistance is so interesting, because they do not see that it benefits them that there are people who don't fear death. Mm-hmm. Right? And that just right. As the good shepherd doesn't fear death, his sheep who have become shepherds don't fear death. And that is a threat to people who use the fear of death in order to gain control. Oh, that's helpful, Ethan. That helps me a lot understand, you know, who would ever be opposed to the goodness of the good shepherd? Those who stand to lose something by this kind of freedom that we have, because the sting of death has been removed by the resurrection.
How does that fit in, do you think? Because this is where we finally hear about, well, we hear about love in the gospel reading, but by this we know love, that Jesus laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. This is, I guess, where the rubber hits the road, right?
Yeah.
Where we're finally explicitly told, lay down your life for the brothers, sacrifice, and let God's, since God's love abides in you, let it be shown, not just in word, but in deed and in truth.
Love cannot help but be expressed in acts.
Right.
In acts of love, or as Kierkegaard said, in works of love, which is...
Right, but it's not like... But in there, that makes it sound like it's could be solely spontaneous. But there is a practicing of that love.
But again, Jesus laid down the condition that it can't be coerced. His
right.
love was not coerced. And so this is the question that I have, and what I would like to solve in the sermon is, how can people hear the love command not as coercive, but as an invitation to actually be a participant in Christ's life, which is, you know, when you that is our heart's desire, is to participate in the life that Christ has given us. So,
well, and you get this language of abiding, right, which is common throughout John's writings, Christ abiding in us and us in him. And it makes me think of the classical concept of friendship, where you have one soul dwelling in two bodies.
Yeah.
That there's sort of a oneness there that ties people together, and yet their individual lives are still acknowledged. Those lives then are used in a mutual service to one another.
Well, this is helpful. This has changed for me, because that the accent, which seems to be on, at first, on the goodness of the good shepherd, is actually, all of these are defining what love actually means, and what it means for us to say that we love God, and because of that, we love our neighbor.
Thank you, David and Ethan, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.